Here we go. Writing to us is good and good for you. Whatever you get, just the letter of the day. I was just texting a friend of mine, Tom, working on the horses and getting the cart ready for the 4th of July parade there in Edmonds. And I think we should have our listeners, like Mr. 253 should be there. I would like, when we go by, if we're able to really organize this thing, I want the people of Edmonds to go, what the hell? Like that kind of feeling. Like, what was that?
I think we should do it virtually. It'll be an invisible float, an invisible, you know, like radio deserves.
And how would that be? Just one person just carrying
Jacob.
Okay, Jacob's just going to be carrying a
with
small
sound effects,
small transistor radio, just carrying that on his shoulders.
Yeah, we could talk. Yeah, we could talk through the transistor radio. I love that. Hi, everybody. Hello, Edmonds.
Hey, all right.
I did
Clippity
look up
clop.
Yes, yes.
The Edmonds Chamber of Commerce. The deadline to register is next week, a week from today, the 21st. Yeah. And it does look like $35. We'll need at least $35.
All right.
$500 entry fee for any person running for political office. So as long as neither of you are planning a political run, we'll just.
I think there's a $100 commercial fee, though. Would we be considered a commercial entity?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Well, let's start a GoFundMe for that. So far, good. Thank you for looking into that. I think we're well on our way. I was the grand marshal of 4 Seafair parades in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
1 year, Tom. It was my big year when I was the grand marshal of all those little parades. It was fun.
There were protests, though, too, right?
Okay, Tom. I don't know if you know Spanish. Unnecesito, okay? Unnecesito.
No mas. No mas.
Oh, no,
that's
no.
That's my Spanish.
Yeah, well, there's no necesito on the other stuff. All right, so here's what you got. You got a very interesting situation with Mitch McConnell, who's being asked about whether or not he would nominate, or if it's 2024, and if the Senate if the Republicans get control of the Senate again
in 2022,
will he, and if Biden were to nominate somebody, this is, goes back to the same situation with Merrick Garland, and Mitch McConnell was being asked about it. He was on with Hugh Hewitt, and he said would he nominate a Biden?
Would the rule that you applied in 2016?
Yeah, thanks, Hugh.
So the Scalia vacancy apply in 2024 to any vacancy that occurred then?
Well, I think in the middle of a presidential election, if you have a Senate of the opposite party of the president, you have to go back to the 1880s to find the last time a vacancy was filled. So I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election. What was different in 2020 was we were of the same party as the president, and that's why we went ahead with it.
There you go. That's talking about Amy Coney Barrett.
Coney Barrett, yeah.
Yeah, being nominated in 2020. So that now the pressure is upon Breyer. Justice Breyer to step down. I think he's 81 or 82 years old, and some Democrats are saying, hey, listen, get out now, leave now. In fact, there's a giant van parked out in front of the Supreme Court with a big picture, and it says, you know, please retire, and it's time for a black female to be on this justice. Have you seen the big van that's out there, Tom? How'd you like to have that?
No.
You go into work every day, and there's a big van out front telling you to retire?
Huh? Well, first off, let's talk about how despicable Mitch McConnell is. Okay, I think that's just a given. Now, it's a pure political power play. When he held off on Merrick Garland, he gave this flowery comment about, well, no, we'll let the electorate decide, and so we can't do it. And yet when tide was turned, all that phony philosophy went out the window. It was a pure power play. Now, you can argue, and I think there are examples of despicable behavior, I'm sure, on the Democrats' part.
But can't
just in terms of what he's doing, good, you're not trying, but that's good. The thing is it's a pure power play on his part. It has nothing to do with what's good or right or balanced in this country. Now, the thing about
I think what he said was, you got to go all the way back to 1880 something in order find that case. But, Tom, listen,
yes, you know why
everything
that's a false
in politics,
argument?
Everything in politics is power.
everything is power.
Yeah, see, I don't
majority
think
and power and strength.
Yes.
And what he's
okay.
saying is if you reverse the roles, you think the Democrats would do the same? No, it's he's playing by the same thing. He
well,
has
actually,
the power in order to be able to have it in place. So
okay.
there you go.
Actually, that had happened. But when he's referring to the 1880 situation, the reason that's just a false equivalence is that it's only come up like three times in the last 100 years because it has to have a confluence of all sorts of events, like an unexpected death, like Scalia's or Ginsburg's. But yes, no. So now, what is the issue with Breyer? One of the biggest problems I have with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her brilliant, historically significant career is that she hung on so long that we now have Amy Coney Barrett as her replacement. At 87, if she had retired in when she was 83 or something, and Obama was still in power, then we could have had another. We, the Democrats or the liberals, would have another justice. So then the question now becomes: if you've got a guy, a cutthroat like McConnell, who is not going to let any Democratic guy person through if he can all help it, which didn't used to be the case, but now things have soured on both sides. I grant you that. Should Breyer at this point retire now so he can allow for a Democratic Congress or Senate barely to approve of a Biden nominee? Because we've just heard from Mitch McConnell that if Mitch McConnell had his say, and he might in the next two elections, then he wouldn't let anybody get in. That might be reason enough for Breyer, given the example of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, how much it cost.
Ginsburg was asked about that, and she said, well, who would you replace me with?
Yes.
So you won't find somebody better than me.
She's right, but impractical.
Okay, well,
if we could have her there and say, okay, but if you hold on as long as you can, and you're going to be replaced by Amy Coney Barrett instead, who is anathema to everything that Ruth Bader Ginsburg felt judicially, then she might say, well, yes, given that, I was willing to take the risk, and she almost made it. She, fell a few months short, unfortunately, but if she knew that that was going to be the draw, she might have retired and realized, okay, for the good of what of all the principles I believe in, I will step down because the person that replaces me may not be as good as me, but they're going to live 30 years longer than me, and therefore it would be worth the trade.
Okay. I think it's interesting that you refer to it as a power play when it's all about power. Everything's about power.
AOC used to be.
I don't know when it wasn't, Tom. You tell me historically when the people in power didn't want to keep in power and that politics wasn't exactly a very, very ruthless game. When was politics a beanbag or, it's not about patty cake. It is extremely aggressive and it's all about power. Here's AOC explaining.
Do you think that Justice Breyer should step down after this term?
We have had very difficult experiences with making, I believe, the opposite mistake. And especially if Senate Democrats are not going to pass reforms on HR1, we cannot rely solely on a wish of winning elections, particularly in the Senate, when voting rights are under attack in Georgia, Arizona, and Texas, across the country. And if we're not going to pass HR1 with the preemptive clauses that can roll some of that voter suppression attacks back, I believe that we should protect our Supreme Court. And I thought that should absolutely be a consideration.
So what you're saying is that if we can't do it in the Senate, if we can't do it legislatively, then we'll do it in the courts.
Just to be clear, you do think that
That's not the purpose of the court.
Justice Stephen Breyer should retire at the end of this term.
For the right.
You know, I it's something I think about, but I would probably lean towards yes. But yes, you're asking me this question, so I would give more thought to it. But but I'm inclined to say yes.
See, that's good. But John, just to clarify, up until like the Bork nomination, and even after, a lot of the Supreme Court justices were practically unanimous, 90 to 10 kind of things. I mean, there used to be this tradition that whoever was in power in the presidency would get, unless there was something outrageous in the nominee's past, would get passed. It's become very partisan in the last 30, 40 years, but it used to be just a general assent, and that's where things have changed now. And now it's pure power play. I agree.
Well, it's unfortunate because when you read what judges that have had that position for years have said, that our job is not to write law. Do a better job, as Roberts said, Scalia said, do a better job writing better legislation and don't make us try to fix your mistakes. That's not what we're here to do. We are here to just tell you whether this is constitutional or not. That's all. But not to rewrite. So when you put the word state in there and you capitalize it, as Roberts had to do when it came to Obamacare, then he has to determine, do I save this entire piece of legislation that's been so sloppily written? The idea also that we always have these litmus tests. So how are you going to rule on abortion, or how are you going to rule on this or that? They didn't have those kind of questions back then because you didn't have the kind of power. You didn't have the sort of sloppy lazy legislative stuff that is happening now. But to the extent that the judges have to be ruling on these, here's the other part of it is Breyer was asked whether or not you should have these things be limited with the lifetime. And he said, he says 15 or 20 years seems to make sense when they originally came up with this idea that you would serve for a lifetime. He said, one, you didn't live as long, so you couldn't have somebody serving as long. So maybe that would work out a little better. More from McConnell talking about.
You mentioned Justice Breyer. I do want to give him a shout out, though, because he joined what Justice Ginsburg said in 2019, that nine is the right number for the Supreme Court. And I admire him for that. I think even the liberal justices on the Supreme Court have made it clear court packing is a terrible idea.
Yeah, it's Breyer's.
But he would block him if he had a chance.
Yeah.
He's commending him on the one thing where he agrees with him on.
Yeah.
Still, it's an interesting political issue. And right now, the Republicans have taken advantage of the fact that it means more. The Supreme Court nominations or the Supreme Court justices mean more to the right than they do to the left. And that may shift once the right ends up like moving outlawing abortion in some form. That might rejuvenate the left, but right now, because of the abortion issue, the right has always been more the political invigoration of the Supreme Court has meant more to the right than the left, and now they have the advantage,
and they have the advantage
thanks to Mitch McConnell.
Right, because Mitch McConnell playing by whatever rules have been set in place. But somebody like Chuck Schumer had talked about court packing. So, I mean, they're just as vicious, whether it's right or left. I guess it depends on your friends and who you want to be in control.
In response to, McConnell.
So the other part of this, it's a razor thin, 50-50 right now in the Senate, thanks to what the President Trump was able to screw things up and
the crap only good
all
thing
over
he
Georgia.
Did in this entire 4 years.
Thank you. But you do have some oldies in there. You got Patrick Leahy, who went away with a heart attack in January. His health, sometimes people say, was in question. Bernie Sanders, everybody's favorite millionaire socialist. Also, health, not necessarily the best. So you got those two guys in there. They're trying to knock Ron Johnson out. So there are a bunch of moves in play. The Senate could move back to the Republican position, and then you would have Mitch McConnell in there. He was then asked, hey, what if you don't have the power? And if you have to have this thing come up sooner rather than later, he goes, well, we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. So,
They were asking, what if it happens 18 months, before an election?
Out.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's a great political, situation that's going to be worked out, I guess.
People try to do the tea leaves reading. So they say, did the Supreme Court justices put new interns, and if they hired new staff? That's often the case. I think it's every year, every 2 years, they bring a new staff in. And they said, if the person goes ahead and brings new staff in, new
like
interns.
Breyer.
If they did, then there's a pretty good chance they won't be leaving. That's not necessarily the case because others have brought in and then retired. Breyer has hired a whole new group to come in with him, and he the last time they spoke to him about retiring, he says he has no intention at this point. So
Who also has been talked about, this was actually during the Trump administration, that Clarence Thomas now has been on the court so long that he is obviously biding his time. He is not going to retire or step down while Biden is in power, or the Democrats in the Senate at least, but he might be one of the first to retire to extend the reach of the conservatives on the court if the Republicans take over next go-around.
It is sad, because it's out of whack That's not the way it was supposed to go. That you're not supposed to have big major pieces of legislation, which is the only big pieces of major legislation that Democrats have been able to successfully move through the House or Senate, is all happening in the Supreme Court. The three big ones, Obamacare and abortion, were the big ones, and the third one was gay rights or gay marriage. Those are the three big accomplishments.
Abortion was a long time ago.
Yes. Think of some of the other big major pieces of legislation that the Democrats have been able to carry. Crickets. They don't. They make it and they have it actually succeed within the court, not through the normal legislative powers of the elected officials making the determination. So you had Democrats succeed with abortion in the Supreme Court, Obamacare, and then also with gay marriage. Those are your three biggies.
Well, yeah, they're three biggies. But I mean, the rights had three biggies too. They got the interpretation of the Second Amendment. You've got Citizens United that says corporations are people. There are big, issues on both sides of the ledger. I do think in the last 30, 40 years, it's a bit like in sports now, too. The politics of the court has become so specialized that we're now much more aware. In the past, I think that the judges were put on the Supreme Court as generalists. They weren't particularly this and that, but now we've become so sophisticated in terms of our judicial philosophies, and so, there's so many distinctive camps that you can now pick, okay, this guy agrees more with me, or this woman agrees more with me along judicial philosophies, which decide things. And that wasn't ever the case. But you could argue, well, that's fine because they become more specialized. It's like right now, no pitcher pitches nine innings, or very rarely. You've got somebody who's a closer, somebody who's this or that. That the definition of what makes a judge is much more specific, and now you got the Federalist Society who gives a preferred list. These are the people that qualify for our vision of the world that Republicans can identify with. That never used to be the case, and now it's very specialized.
Right. You have the Federalists on one side, and then you have whatever the name of that lawyer association is on the other side that picks the other one. Gets down to, are they originalists? Do they read the Constitution and say, well, this is the Constitution, and these are the words, and this is the intent? Or do we describe it as a living body or a living, breathing document that can change with the times? And then, at that point, all bets are off. So, good. Breyer hangs in there, and we'll see how they continue to rule. They've got a couple of big, big cases that are going to be interesting.
You see, they just delayed, John, though, the Harvard admissions
I saw
test.
That.
They crazy. They haven't not decided. They're just holding off till October, maybe.
Definitely take that one up. All right, Tracy Taylor looking at traffic for us on a big Monday. All right, let's get Arbell in here. Listen, Kyra Seven's got my back. Who's got my front, by the way?
Louis Vuitton.
Oh, there she is. She is.
Hi.
She's not quite as big and best. Well, you know what? Again, it's always a neck and neck. If you try to judge who's the biggest and best in Northwest, it's Muckleshoot Casino, Rachel Bell, right behind them. And if she wants to come back another life as a pizza from Muckleshoot Casino.
You know what the truth is? You haven't laid eyes upon me in at least 6 months. I could be the biggest and the best. I could be bigger than Muckleshoot Casino at this point. What do you know?
A lot of people have gained parking lots and weight over the the choices during the COVID lockdown. All right. Last time you had done some sort of restaurant review, you told us about this place where this chef was horrible and treated people really awful, and they had gotten rave reviews of this restaurant. And now you bring with us another type of story, very similar.
Yes, I will clarify, what I did before was not a restaurant review. It was revealing very bad behavior by an owner and a chef. And so the same thing again. And at what point these stories kind of start all running together, because how many times can you hear about a male chef who has been mistreating women sexually in the kitchen? But I think it's important to bring up when it's these major players like this one is today. So Eduardo Jordan, he has been the darling of the Seattle restaurant scene. He has three restaurants, but he's most famous for June Baby, which is in the Ravenna neighborhood. And so he won two James Beard Awards. He was the first black chef to win a James Beard Award. This was a few years ago. The New York Times called June Baby the hottest new Southern restaurant in the country in 2018. And you could not get into this restaurant. You just couldn't. And I consume so much food media. And for a while, he was literally on every magazine and newspaper that I opened. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan proclaimed November 28th as Eduardo Jordan Day. So just to give you the background on how beloved this chef is and his food. So I was actually shocked. I don't know why I'm continued to be shocked when these things come out, but I was yesterday when I got texts from many people sending me the Seattle Times article. And the headline is Eduardo Jordan, acclaimed Seattle chef, accused by 15 women of sexual misconduct or unwanted touching. And my first response was, who's left? Like, who are the good guys? And, you know, who's going to be next? So the Seattle Times interviewed 28 people. So it was these 15 women who came forward, but then they also spoke to other employees of the restaurants and roommates of the employees, people who said that they saw these things happen or heard the stories firsthand or saw the texts that were exchanged. So there were four women that said that he groped them at work. I won't get into all the details. Some of them are a little bit graphic. He tried to kiss a woman on a business trip. That's story was he invited this female coworker, I think to go to Vancouver, BC with him on some kind of tasting trip. And she was so excited because, again, just like all these stories you hear, these are people of power who are really high up in the restaurant scene. And they believe that, you know, if they can work here, they can work anywhere. And on that trip, she says they got to the hotel room and he had only gotten one bed. She didn't know where else to go. She didn't have any money. She gets in the bed fully clothed. He tried to kiss her. Anyway, the stories go on and on from 2012 to 2017. And he has said that none of this has happened. He denies everything except for the one time he said he did try to kiss a coworker. He says that it was inappropriate and it was a learning experience. And he sent this big, long email to the Seattle Times. And within it, he said, you know, this is the kind of conduct that I don't allow at my restaurants. Quote, workplace harassment of any nature or sexualizing women is not a culture I promote or who I am or what I'm about. I stand behind that. So, you know, there's always the same question and the same answer every time a story like this comes up, which is, why didn't anybody file a police report? Why didn't anybody bring this up sooner? And it's always the same answer. Young women are afraid because they're afraid they're going to get fired. They're afraid that their reputation is going to get smeared. And in this case, you know, not only was he a powerful and important chef in the game, but he had these big partnerships with brands like Lexus and Blue Apron. So people are afraid of retaliation and also, I think, yeah, to lose their jobs. And, you know, it's not surprising because he has denied everything. The last piece of this is most of the women who accused him of sexual misconduct are white. And when they were interviewed, they said they were afraid to say something because they didn't want to undermine the success of a talented black chef in an industry that has too often devalued the contributions of people of color. So, like I said, he was the first black chef to win this prestigious award, which is basically the Oscars of the food world. Mm-hmm. And so, especially in a town like Seattle, which is not especially diverse, I could see how people would be afraid that, you know, they were trying to tear him down.
So don't judge him. Judge him by the color of his skin, but not by the content of his character.
Well, I mean, in this case, they just were afraid that what they were saying would be misconstrued, that people would take it the wrong way and think that they were trying to tear him down as a black chef and they wanted to continue to support him. There's a lot of psychological things at play. Yeah. But the point is that it's just depressing and it's sad. And you would think even after, you know, the huge Me Too movement came out, that chefs would at least start to watch their back and stop doing these things, at least just so they would be afraid of getting caught. You know, the fact that they continue to do it is baffling to me.
Okay, so I've never worked in a restaurant.
I have 15 years.
I know you have. And everything I hear about this kitchen culture, it just sounds like this. And I have friends who worked in restaurants, and they say, it's just the way of the world. It's a bit like people used to talk about the newsrooms, and things in newsrooms have really changed, primarily, I think, because we have so many more women in our newsrooms. But there was just this kind of, you know, black humor culture and a sexy culture, and the something about kitchen culture is like it's hothouse of sexuality. A lot of young people, you know, working in it. It's fast paced. It's high adrenaline rush.
There's a lot of alcohol.
Yeah, there's free flowing alcohol. Is there something about the kitchen culture that is responsible for this? Do chefs just, I don't understand why chefs have such power, but apparently they rule the roost and they can rule it however they want, and it tends to be hothouse sexual.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just something that got established a long time ago with this kind of male culture and this power structure. And for the past several years, you know, people have been trying to dismantle it. And, you know, you never hear, I've never heard about a female chef doing this to anybody, have you? I mean, there's something, I mean, in this case, you know, Eduardo Jordan had worked in many other restaurants, and people who had worked with him in other restaurants in Seattle and then worked for him when he got his own place said that when he got his own place, the behavior just really amped up. And I don't know if that's because he was his own boss and he felt like he couldn't get caught by anyone, or if it's, you know, it's a power thing. I think a lot of the time it does have to do with power. And I think that that's escalated with the way that chefs have been treated in pop culture, you know, with Food Network and celebrity chefs. Being a chef in the 70s, you were not a star. Like, I've heard a million stories of people saying they wanted to become a chef and their parents were like, absolutely not. That is not what you're going to do. And now, you know, it's something that people aspire to because they can be famous. And so I think there's a big ego that comes along with that.
People magazine named him one of the sexiest chefs. He was number 4 or 5 on the list of sexy chefs in 2018. 90% of the women, 90% of women that work in restaurant industry say they've been sexually harassed. It's sexually harassed. 70% of men say they too have been sexually harassed in the restaurant industry. When I worked at a particular restaurant that was very well known in New York City, I was the only straight guy there. And I can tell you right now, the stuff that was said was just part of the life in the restaurant. And you just kind of went with it. But,
well, people,
you know, never
aren't going
physically
with it anymore. No. I forgot to add one detail before we go, that every single one of his employees has walked out and he's had to close his restaurants because nobody will work there.
Yeah, today. I mean, the article appeared in the front page of the Seattle Times Sunday edition yesterday, and they all quit today.
Yep.
I guess it only takes one or two to break the, you know, to break through, and then everyone else goes, yep, you know what? I'm going to say something too, right? So that's
yeah,
what you
and it's
with.
Like, what's the harm in quitting right now? Every single restaurant is understaffed and looking for people to work there. So if they quit there, they can very easily get a job any other kitchen in the city right now.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Thank you, Arbel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here comes Tracy Taylor looking at traffic for us. Lots of folks writing to us. That's great. Everybody's trying to become Letter of the Day, and that is a wonderful honor that you and your whole family can enjoy. When you become Letter of the Day, as chosen by a teeny tiny lady in a pickle jar, how many people can say that they have experienced that firsthand? Do we have time to get to the man being eaten by a whale? What do you think, Jacob? Yes or no? Yes or no?
Oh, Jacob's not in the studio. So
oh, never mind. Here we go.
Diver out of Provincetown, Massachusetts, and I was diving today. I jumped over and I got down to about 45 feet of water, and all of a sudden I just felt this huge bump and everything went dark, and I could sense that I was moving, and I was like, oh my God, did I just get bit by a shark? And then I felt around and I realized,
by the way, there's a truck backing up, but just keep interviewing him anyway.
There was no teeth. And I had felt really no great pain. And then I realized,
a real professional who's ever doing this from WBZ TV.
Oh my God, I'm in a whale's mouth. I'm in a whale's mouth.
That's a sound, Tom. When a whale backs up, you don't often hear it, but they put that in there.
And he's trying to swallow me.
This guy, hold on.
That just kills
the man. Is scuba diving. He's 45 feet of water. A whale picks him up. And he's in the whale's mouth, and the guy doesn't have time to stop with the thing backing up.
And I thought to myself, okay, this is it. This is, I'm going to die.
Wow. Wow.
And the beeping backup sound happens right when he gets to this punchline. I was inside the whale's mouth.
Yes.
And the beep, beep, beep. So he has to repeat it. Whale's mouth.
Mouth.
Did you hear me? Beep,
beep.
And
all of a sudden, he went up to the surface and just erupted and started shaking his head. And I just got thrown in the air and landed in the water. And I was free. And I just floated there. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I got out of that. And I'm here to tell it, and
Thought my legs were broken, but I'm all bruised up, and I made it.
And they said, what was going through your head?
What were you thinking when you were in the grasp of this whale, other than you're going to die?
It was happening so fast. My only thought was how to get out of that mouth, and I realized there was no overcoming a beast of that size, that he was going to do with me what he wanted to do, and it was either he spit me out or he swallowed me, and I didn't. And I was actually in his mouth probably a good 30 seconds, but I still had my regulator in my mouth. I was still breathing, and I was just wondering. Actually, one of the things that went through my mind is just, oh my God, what if he does swallow me? And here I am, I'm breathing air, and I'm breathing this whale's mouth until my air runs out. Crazy stuff.
Wow.
It is. It's a spectacular story. Now, I'm sure there are some skeptics, but they did talk to people. They say it's very rare, but not impossible. That would make sense, that these kinds of whales, they're sort of like those big dragnet fishing operations where they just swoop. They just open their big gaping maw, and then, all the water and whatever's in this certain area gets sucked in, and then they kind of like spit out what they don't want. They said he was probably too big to go down the throat of the whale, whatever, the esophagus or something. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he got spit out. He's lucky to be alive, because he could have been crushed to death. But there were witnesses that said, yeah, they saw him. He was picked up 45 feet underwater, so nobody saw that. But they did see the whale, sort of push him out, throw him out of the mouth at the top. So they saw him flying through the air. So I think there's more reason to believe this than not.
It would have been a 15 to 18 hour journey from the mouth of the whale to the whale's anus, Tom.
That's one long movie.
Thought I'd share that with everybody.
That's
Thank
hilarious.
You.
You're welcome. All right. At commute home, longer or shorter than the journey from the whale of mouth to the whale's anus?
Less pleasant, even.
I think it would be shorter. I'm guessing it would be shorter.
Right. So then that's a positive.
It is.
Why don't you put it in that perspective from now on?
I will do that.
Could be worse.
Oh, my gosh.